As we cast our eyes around this vast planet, the overwhelming fact that confronts us is the great inequality of the world's peoples. This fact is so obvious that it should hardly need stating. The inequalities are there in every imaginable form: stature, physique, color of eyes, hair and skin, facial features, strength, energy, temperament, and not least, intellect. And these inequalities are reflected everywhere in the level of achievement of the different peoples. In some parts of the world, we see great wealth. In others, poverty and squalor. In some parts, a high technology. In others, ways of doing things that have changed little, if at all, over the centuries. Culturally, the differences are equally great. What is music to the natives of one land or continent is just discordant noise to those of another. What is art to the European bears no relation to what is art to the African. For thousands of years, man has recognized these enormous differences without even having to argue about them. They're so self-evident that such a debate is no more necessary than it is to debate whether summer is warmer than winter or night darker than day. And very few people have ventured to suggest that to acknowledge these great differences, these obvious inequalities, is to be unkind or offensive to this race or that. Every race has been recognized as having its place in nature's scheme of things, and to confuse the place of one race with another was not to help anybody. At the same time, to express preference for associating with one's own race was not regarded as expressing hatred for other races. Only in very recent times have people tried to deny these simple facts and laws. Suddenly, in the 20th century, we decide that we're going to throw overboard all the wisdom of thousands of years and start pretending that there are no differences between the world's races, other than those of color, that every race has the same capacity to do this or that as every other race, that where there are differences in the achievement of different races, these arise not from anything genetic, not from anything in the blood, but from environment, from economic causes, from the fact that one race has not had the opportunity to do what another race has done, perhaps because of poverty, perhaps because of exploitation by another race. As part of this, it's now become the accepted dogma that there's nothing wrong with a member of one race marrying into another, even if the two races belong to two wholly different cultures and different stages of evolution. Not only is this accepted now, but it's been actively encouraged everywhere. And to cap it all, we now have laws which make it a crime to speak openly and specifically about these thousands of years old racial differences, or to discriminate between one race or another in granting employment to people, in accepting people to membership of societies or clubs. I myself am one of those who have been sent to prison for writing things which pointed out certain realities about the world's different races, which had been accepted by our ancestors for many centuries. What I'm able to say in this talk is strictly limited by these laws, which, if I overstep them, could send me to prison again. I must avoid certain phrases. I must avoid stark comparisons. I must talk at times in parables. This is a measure of the state of insanity that we've reached on the subject of race today. After being able, for thousands of years, to approach the matter rationally and realistically. Today we're told by our politicians and our journalists and our broadcasters that racism is evil. Some say the greatest evil. That racists, that is to say, people who still believe that races are different and should be treated differently, are dangerous agitators who should be silenced, even locked up. But if we're to believe this, we must then believe that the vast majority of our ancestors were wrong. We must believe that what was accepted reality for all those thousands of years was a falsehood, and an evil falsehood at that. We must deny our whole heritage, our whole history, our whole culture. We must start by denying Shakespeare, who was pretty clear about the differences between the races. We must deny Kipling. We must say of our countrymen, who again and again repelled the invader from these shores, Drake, Nelson, and others, that they were wrong. They should have allowed the invader in, because there are no racial or national differences. What did it matter if we had a Spanish king or a Corsican emperor? That is the logic of the present view that racism cannot be accepted. But if it was not wrong to repel these invaders of past ages, who at least were Europeans, who at least shared the same broad culture as ourselves, how much less wrong can it be today for us to oppose the invasion of this country and the permanent settlement in this country of people who come from entirely different continents and totally different cultures? One of the foremost opponents of racism today is the established church. Yet did the church spend the previous centuries crusading against racism and for the integration of the different races? There's no record of it. Why then, after centuries in which, from the point of view of the church, racial differences have been quite acceptable, indeed, even the Holy Bible recognizes them, why now does the church turn round and say that they're not acceptable and that we must fight racism? The leaders of the church should know something about racial differences. Almost every day of their lives, they live and work in an environment that is a testimony to the unique European genius. They are able to gaze up to the towering heights of the great churches and cathedrals, to observe the intricate carvings and the magnificent works of art that decorate the ceilings and roofs of those buildings, and to reflect that these were largely the creations of ordinary humble craftsmen, men without education, and without all the modern implements of building, without cranes, without girders, without steel scaffolding, without pneumatic drills, without the multitude of modern tools that we now take for granted. Can the leaders of the church seriously tell us that every other race in the world is equally capable of constructing these great edifices? If so, where is the evidence of it? Where throughout the length and breadth of Africa is there anything even remotely resembling a building of any kind as we know it, except those that have been planned and designed by European architects and constructed under European supervision? This is not to deny that the African has his own special capabilities that are different to ours. This is not to say that his way of life is necessarily inferior, only that it's a way of life different and alien to ours in Britain and Europe. We don't have the African's ability to adapt to his type of environment, and in that respect, we're inferior to him. We may not have the natural athleticism of certain types of Africans, or the ability to survive in intense heat and with little water. Views about superiority or inferiority are anyway always subjective ones. Like beauty, they exist in the eyes of the beholder. It's natural for all of us to believe that the qualities that should be deemed superior are the qualities that we think most important that is to us. That rule holds good in individual attitudes, and it holds good in racial attitudes. No one has ever yet devised a universal standard of superiority that can be accepted by all species. To every species, what is superior is the quality in which it excels. Who can say that the elephant is superior to the crayfish, or that the alligator is superior to the kestrel? We only know that each is different, and it doesn't even take an intellectual debate to tell us this. We have the evidence of our own eyes and our common sense. Anti-racism and multiracialism, the new dogmas of our age, go right against this elementary wisdom. They tell us that something is wrong which all the accumulated knowledge of history, anthropology, science, and simple folklore, acquired over many millennia, tell us is right. And yet today's advocates of anti-racism and multiracialism are not just a few cranks whom we can afford to treat with derision, as we do the members of the Flat Earth Society. There are rulers. They command the dominating heights in politics, in religion, in journalism and broadcasting, in the schools, in the cinema, indeed, practically everywhere. And, like the flat earthers of previous centuries, they regard their dogmas not as something to argue about, but as the word of God, from which there may be no deviation, against which there may be no dissent. Someone who does not accept their point of view is not merely a person with a different opinion, to be treated as they would treat one with a different opinion on free trade, on comprehensive education, on solar energy, or on the treatment for arthritis. Someone who does not accept the current dogma on race is a heretic, to be submitted to today's equivalent of burning at the stake, social ostracism, perhaps dismissal from his job, the denial of any public platform to expound his viewpoint, or, as has happened to me and to some others of my acquaintance, locking up in jail. All this leads to an obvious question. If anti-racism and multiracialism are so overwhelmingly and self-evidently right, if the theory of racial differences, which has prevailed over previous centuries, is so wrong that today no decent or intelligent person could possibly believe in it, why are the advocates of anti-racism and multiracialism, the opponents of race, so reluctant to put the matter up for open public debate and to have reason and common sense decide? These people, after all, call themselves liberals. Now, the origins of liberalism are supposed to lie in the spirit of reason, in the Enlightenment, as embodied in the philosophies of Voltaire and Rousseau, Locke and Bentham, in the idea that no doctrine or theory is so sacred that it should not be subjected to scrutiny and criticism. And yet here we have the people who like to think of themselves as the modern heirs to that tradition, refusing adamantly to subject the question of multiracialism to this simple and basic rule. Surely this does not suggest confidence in their case. Surely if they were confident that they were so clearly right and others so clearly wrong, they should be glad to put the matter up for open argument, so that they could then prove the superiority of their own viewpoint and the foolishness of their opponents. What better way to establish the wrongness of the racist viewpoint than to allow it to be heard, to listen to all its arguments, and then knock those arguments down, demolish them by the presentation of a more convincing case? That is the time-honored way in which, across the ages, people who felt genuinely about the rightness of their cause have been prepared to defend it. But the liberals, who profess to believe in multiracialism, and who so vehemently attack those who disagree with them, are not prepared to do this. Why not? We can only conclude that they have much less confidence in their case than they would have us think. Another extraordinary thing is the fact that even today, no one seriously thinks of applying anti-racist or multiracialist theories to the breeding of racehorses, cattle, sheep, dogs, trees, flowers, vegetables. Here all the traditional laws of biology are observed. If they weren't, farmers would put themselves out of business in less than a year, as would horticulturalists, foresters, and countless other types of businessmen and sportsmen. Yet when it comes to the human species, we break all the laws that we apply to other species. We pretend that one breed can be crossed with another, totally different breed, and the soundness of the stock preserved. What a lunacy. Let me at this point come back to a question mentioned earlier, the question of the influence of the environment, of opportunity, poverty, exploitation, etc., on the development of races. Straight away, let us accept that these influences do play some part. Of course, a person whose life is not dogged by poverty is going to be more healthy, more energetic than those who do suffer continual poverty. And he's going to have more time to cultivate himself if he's not continually having to work around the clock to make ends meet. Likewise, a person who has the benefit of education should have some advantage over one who has no education. On the other hand, it could be argued that poverty, to a person of real character and determination, is a spur to climb up in the world, to make that extra effort to rise out of poor surroundings. Many of the most successful men in this world have come from very poor backgrounds, those very backgrounds being to them an advantage, in the sense that the motivation to improve their condition was much greater than in the case of someone being born into security and comfort. But at the end of the day, we must ask this simple question. What has created, in the first place, the poverty and unfavorable environment that are a lot of many of the races of the world? Did we British and other Europeans land on this earth and find ourselves at the very start surrounded by ready-made institutions of education available to everyone? Did we find left for us on a table, as if delivered by Santa Claus, the implements of wealth, technology, knowledge, and skills that are now associated with the white races and a few other races, such as the Japanese? The answer, of course, is no. We started at the same starting point. We have nothing. All these advantages that we enjoy today, our ancestors created on their own initiative and from out of their own resources of intelligence and ingenuity. And today, present generations of our people are creating yet new assets of the same kind, such as the know-how to travel in outer space, to fly many times the speed of sound, to transmit pictures by satellite to the other side of the world, to store in an area the size of a pea the content of the Encyclopedia Britannica by the process of photographic reduction. The question must be asked, why did other races, starting also from base, not develop the same amenities? Of course, some have done, and I mentioned the Japanese as an example, but the majority have not. Why not, if all the races are equal and the belief in race differences is wrong? And what about this business of exploitation? The word exploitation is one much used by people on the left. Of course, you could say that a man of superior brains, who uses the labor of another man with lesser brains but who wants a job and a roof over his head, is an exploiter of that other man. He is making use of that man for his own ends. But so is the other man, in a sense, an exploiter of him. He is using the brains of his boss to get what he wants, a living, enough for a square meal, and a place to put his head at night. The fact is that in most cases where whites exploited non-whites in the European colonies and in the United States, it suited the non-whites to be exploited. For by being exploited, they were able to avail themselves of benefits which most others of their kind could never have. We are told today that non-whites are being exploited in South Africa. Well, it can't be too bad for them. Otherwise, we wouldn't see millions of them migrating from other parts of Africa, where presumably they're not exploited by white people, into South Africa, where we're told they are. The life of exploitation, which they live in South Africa under the whites, must be much better than the life they've lived elsewhere in Africa, under their fellow blacks. But here we must go into a deeper question. Why is it, historically, a fact that it has always been a case of blacks being exploited, i.e. ruled, led, and hired as labor by whites, and hardly ever a case of whites being exploited by blacks? Again, we must ask, how did it all start? The good Lord did not create a world in the first place in which he placed blacks under whites by his own decree. Blacks came under the domination of whites in various places in the world where the two races came into contact with each other, not the other way around. If races were inherently exactly the same, with the same latent capacities for development, on the law of averages, there would have been just as many cases of blacks dominating and exploiting whites as there have been of whites dominating and exploiting blacks. So why hasn't this happened? And as for education, today there are many parts of the world where blacks are getting the same education as whites. In Britain, in the United States, for example. And yet this similarity of education is not producing two similar types of people. Everywhere where it's happening, we find that blacks, on average, are failing to benefit from their educational opportunities in the same way as whites. And this can't be explained, as some would like to explain it, in terms of the poorer homes the blacks grow up in. In the United States, American Indians, who grow up in even poorer homes than the blacks, consistently score higher in academic achievement than the blacks, although still much lower than the whites. And when we speak of poor, we're only speaking relatively. We mean poor in relation to the average white. In America today, most Negroes and a good many Indians own motor cars and colored TV sets and enjoy far higher standards of living than most white Americans enjoyed in the earlier part of this century. And we must not forget that in the earlier part of this century, American standards of living were higher than among white people anywhere else in the world. All these facts should serve to convince us that the foundations of the race equality theory are absolutely non-existent, and that the case for the existence of racial differences, inherent biological differences, and not just social and educational ones, is overwhelming. As I said before, this is not a question of inferiority or superiority, only of difference. Nor is it a case of one race being good and another race being bad. These questions of good and bad, like those of superior and inferior, depend on the culture, tradition, outlook, and ethos to which you belong. Least of all is it a matter of hatred. Speaking personally, I have no hatred whatever for the black or brown or yellow races. But that's just my choice. That's the way I feel. It seems to me utterly silly for me to try to tell another person that he should not hate these races if that is his natural disposition. Even more would it be silly for me to try to legislate to prevent that person hating other races or jailing him if he did. In fact, I would suggest that the very existence today of laws and punishment against those who would dislike other races is itself an admission of the failure of the whole multiracial experiment. Those races that are naturally likable to other races and acceptable to those other races in the majority do not need laws to compel those other races to accept them. If the integration today of distant races into our own British society was a natural process, opposed only by a cranky few, there would be no need of legislation to make it an offence for people to say anything against them. If things said against them were untrue, unjust, or unfair, most people would ignore those things. For centuries in Britain, we've had jokes about Irishmen being stupid, Scots being mean, Welshmen being thieves, and so on. It's never occurred to anyone to bring in laws to protect Irish, Scots, and Welsh against these jokes, because the vast majority know that most Irish are intelligent, most Scots generous, and most Welsh honest. They know from their own experience of mixing with such people. Isn't it a confession of failure, then, that we must now have laws and punishments to deter folk from saying disagreeable things about black people or brown people or Jewish people? Isn't it an admission that while English, Irish, Scots and Welsh have integrated into the one society because they come basically from the one culture and the one stock, these other races have not integrated, and therefore their acceptance must be forced by the compulsion of the state? Now, after all I've said so far, there may be some listening to this talk who will say, all right, you've proved your point. Races are different. But how does this affect me? My answer is that this affects all of us in this country to an extent that would frighten some of you if you really thought the consequences through and didn't see a solution. It affects you whether you live near the center of one of our great cities or in a country cottage far away from the urban blight. It affects you if you live in the peaceful and beautiful highlands of Scotland, in Cornwall, in Lincolnshire, or in the Lake District, just as it affects you if you live in London, Birmingham, Liverpool, Bristol, or Bradford. It affects you because this is all our country. You just cannot shut yourself away in one part of it and be indifferent to what's happening in other parts. That's a selfish attitude. It's also a myopic attitude, because it puts off for the present the facing of a problem that is going to come upon you in the future, whether you like it or not. This country, for better or for worse, is a country in which most of the people live in the larger conurbations. What happens in those large conurbations ultimately determines the destiny of the country as a whole and affects everyone, everywhere. Without obstruction from our political leaders, indeed with their encouragement and blessing, whole areas of urban Britain have been turned in a few years from homogeneous places where there existed united communities, not always wealthy, but at least living at peace with one another, into cauldrons of civil unrest, due to the insane experiment of trying to bring together within them wholly different and incompatible peoples, cultures, and ways of life. I don't need to tell people, even when they live at Land's End or John O'Groats, about the state of war that now exists in these city areas. They have their newspapers and their television sets, and they have seen what's been happening. Tottenham, Brixton, St. Paul's, Moss Side, Toxteth, Handsworth. These names are now written into our consciousness as are the names of battlefields, like the Somme, Passchendaele, Ypres, El Alamein, Normandy, Monte Cassino, the Falklands. But the difference is that while these other famous battles belong to the past, to history, the battles of Tottenham, Brixton, and St. Paul's are liable to break out again, at any time, and again, and again. With our policemen and law-abiding British people in the front line. Mr. Enoch Powell attracted the fury and the hatred of his fellow politicians now nearly 20 years ago, when he said that he foresaw the streets of this country like the Tiber, foaming with blood. It was not too long before his warnings came true. He was consigned to the political wilderness for being right. His critics, who were wrong, continue to rule politics in this country and rule them today. We've seen in recent years the appalling rise in the crime rate, 60% since the coming to office of the Tory government. We've seen the frightening increase in mugging, rape, murder, drug trafficking, arson, looting, child abuse. Now these crimes are equally bad when committed by whites as by blacks. When whites commit them, we should deploy all the resources of the police to hunt them down, just as when blacks commit them. When whites are convicted of these crimes, we should punish them just as severely as we should punish blacks whenever they are convicted of the same crimes. Crime is crime, whatever the race of the criminal, and whatever the figures prove about the propensity of one race to commit more crimes than another race. If the figures show that more football hooligans are white than are black, that doesn't make the black hooligans any the less wrong. And if the figures prove that more muggers and rioters are black than are white, that doesn't make the white muggers and rioters any the less wrong. All should be treated the same. But all are not being treated the same. On the evidence of no less a person than the former Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police of London himself, certainly no racist. Different procedures of policing are now being adopted to deal with black crime than are being adopted with white crime. In situations where the criminals are black, it often happens that to pursue them, to stop them, search them, question them, or arrest them, if it is in one of their own areas, will lead to a riot. Large numbers of their neighbors and friends will attack the police out of solidarity with their own kinfolk. The rules are, therefore, that police will often not, in these situations, go in and enforce the law, but will lay back, hoping for a more favorable opportunity to do so later, at another time, and in another place. This, of course, is the legacy of Tottenham, Brixton, and the other conflagrations that we've seen. I don't need to tell you that this badly impairs police efficiency and puts an extra strain on police manpower and time. It also means that when the most favorable moment comes to stop and search a suspected criminal, favorable, that is, from the standpoint of public peace, he may no longer have in his possession the evidence that's required to convict him. How can our police possibly be expected to fight the war against crime effectively when hamstrung by these rules? And then when colored lawbreakers are brought to court, it so often happens that they're faced by magistrates or judges who believe that, because of some supposed disadvantage in their background, they should be treated more leniently than white offenders who committed the same crimes. Is that a recipe for a fair society or for social harmony? But far, far worse than the actual measurement of the increase in crime that all this causes, far, far worse than the harm done to police efficiency and the rate of crime cleanup, are the implications that the whole business has in terms of the kind of country we've become and the kind of rulers we have who've allowed this to happen. Policing policy at the highest level is determined not by station inspectors or sergeants, but by chief constables, and ultimately by the Home Office, which is responsible for the appointment of those chief constables. The decision that police will tackle crime less zealously and less efficiently when it's committed by members of one race than when it's committed by members of another race, the decision that certain areas of this country will become, effectively, no-go areas not subjected to normal policing, these are political decisions, and the police are merely the instruments of this political will and power. That we've reached a state of affairs when we have political rulers who would make such decisions, dividing the United Kingdom up into two types of country, two territories, subjected to different laws, and the inhabitants of the United Kingdom up into two different categories of citizen, also subjected to different laws. When we've reached that state of affairs, surely it's a terrifying admission of the failure of multiracialism, of the type of country for which we're heading, and above all, a terrifying indication of the kind of political leaders who now govern us. Just why our political leaders act in this way is a question that now leads us to another aspect of the problem. Politicians today are interested in just one thing: keeping office, and that means winning votes. If there were no votes to be won in carrying out policies of the kind I've described, policies that, in effect, place colored lawbreakers in a position favorable by comparison with white lawbreakers, you wouldn't see our politicians do it. Nor would you see them going groveling ingratiatingly to the ethnic minorities with all manner of other special favors, such as cultural, recreational, and housing grants, inner city renewal programs, and so on. The politicians do this because they're conscious of the power that ethnic minority groups now have to determine the outcome of elections, elections to national as well as local government. Sometimes those of us who for years have opposed the policy of allowing large numbers of colored immigrants into this country have used the term takeover. We've been accused of exaggeration. Surely, people have said, as long as these immigrants are not the majority, they cannot take over. But that's incorrect. As we can see after a moment's study of our political system and the balance of political power between the parties, in many areas of Britain now, including some of the most important areas in terms of the size of the population and the number of parliamentary constituencies and local government wards, the size of the non-white population eligible to vote is appreciably larger than the size of the majority enjoyed by the sitting MP or councillor. This means that the ethnic minorities are in a position to decide who gets elected. This might not matter so much if the members of these ethnic minorities voted in the way that most whites do, without thought of representing any racial group or interest. In that case, as many might vote for one candidate or party as for another candidate or party. But most members of the ethnic minorities do not vote in the way that whites do. They vote very much from the standpoint of what they see as best for their own racial group. In this way, by voting on a group basis, they have the ability more and more to determine the result of elections. In that sense, it's not an exaggeration to say that they've taken over. In just the same way, it can happen that one party's majority in Parliament can only be sustained with the support of a large number of ethnic minority voters. And when that happens, it can be said that the ethnic minority groups wield real political power in Britain. In fact, much more political power than may be indicated by their numbers in the population, although those numbers are increasing all the time. This will mean that no government could ever get elected or survive in power when elected if it owns the disfavour of the ethnic minorities in our midst. This will certainly be the case while the white electors are neatly divided up along class and party lines. The only effective bulwark against it would be the overwhelming concentration of white people's votes in support of a political party which white people saw as representing their interest. Before this can happen, white people in this country, the native indigenous British population, must first wake up to the fact that they have a common interest along racial lines, and that they must choose their political loyalties in accordance with that interest. A long and hard process of education is going to be needed before this happens. Of course, the answer to this is predictable. One can see it forming in the mind of the anti-racist and the multiracialist long before it comes. "We must all learn," they'll say, "not to take up a racial attitude. When we have the multiracial society to which we're working, no one will any longer vote at elections in accordance with his race or what he sees as the interest of his race. We will all be British citizens, black, white, brown and yellow, Christian, Muslim, Hindu and Jewish. We will all see elections as having nothing to do with the issues of race." Well, I must immediately bring the person who thinks like that down from the clouds into the real world. And in the real world, however much white people may want to think, feel, act, and vote along non-racial lines, other races in Britain simply do not do so and will not be persuaded to do so. Their whole nature and their whole history militates against it. This is no condemnation of them, only a condemnation of the whites who don't have their hard, businesslike, and realistic attitude to politics, who believe in the vapid slogans about one world, one race, the human race, international brotherhood, and the rest, while non-whites, who in this context are in fact superior in their understanding of things, in their instinct of self-interest, believe only in what is good for them. So here we have a situation already in this country in which ethnic minority groups have established themselves sufficiently strongly in certain areas to wield real political power. We've seen some of the consequences of this in the decisions of national and local government, in respect of law and order, and in the disposal of public funds. Is it an exaggeration to say that we're witnessing a form of foreign conquest, much more subtle, much more unseen, and therefore much more dangerous than any that has so far threatened us in all our long history? And we must add to this danger the fact that those who would conquer us clearly have allies in the form of a fifth column in the British press, British broadcasting, and British government. I will put it to you that beside this fifth column, the Soviet moles like Philby, Burgess, Maclean, and Blunt, a pretty small fry. And to this, we must add another thing. By this process, the population of Britain is gradually changing. The low birth rate among indigenous British people and the much higher birth rate among coloured ethnic minority groups is gradually resulting in an increasing proportion of coloured children in our schools. I'm not stating anything startlingly new when I mention the very high proportion of low achievers that can be found among ethnic minority children, especially West Indians, a fact acknowledged by several educationists who cannot by any stretch of imagination be called racist. This is a horrifying prospect for the future. Only recently, an educational report stated that 70% of children leaving schools today were fit only for jobs of the coolie variety. Part of the cause of this is undoubtedly the inadequate school curriculum and the low teaching standards. But we must not blind ourselves to the other part. The fact that an increasing portion of the youngsters in our schools are possessed of fundamentally different mental and psychological makeup to British and other European children, and simply cannot, through no fault of their own, compete in the kinds of mental aptitudes and skills needed for the running of an advanced Western country. Again, I stress, this is not to say that their brains are inferior, only that they're different. And this is a biological fact that no education on earth can change. I've mentioned the warnings of Mr. Enoch Powell. And in that same speech, Mr. Powell said that Britain, by allowing this to continue, is heaping up her own funeral pyre. Mr. Powell was absolutely right. We British, by our inaction, by our apathy, by, it must be stated, the cowardice of many of us, are in imminent danger of allowing our nation to be destroyed. It certainly will be destroyed within one more generation, if things are allowed to continue as they are. And this is so whether we have a Conservative, Labour, or Liberal or SDP government. All of these parties and their leaders are quite content to let things drift on in the same direction. All are committed to the racial change that's taking place. None will say a stop. There's still time for the ordinary British people to take the action needed to save our country from the disaster that looms ahead of us. But the time is short. The British people must unite and form a new political force to fight this shameful surrender of our country. We have provided the nucleus of this new force in the young party we've created. It is now up to you to swell the numbers of this party and help us in this great task. Remember that this could be the last battle of Britain. If we lose it, there will not be another chance. Nations can come back from military defeat and rise again. That's been proved time and time again in history. But nations cannot survive the destruction of their people through the kind of process that's now taking place in Britain. We must fight to save our people and our country. But let us remember, the fight is not against the immigrants and their offspring. They are not the enemy, but only the victims of the process, just as we are. The fight is against the politicians who are promoting this act of national suicide. We can win this crucial battle, but we cannot win it just by sitting in our armchairs and grumbling. We can only win it through action, and we must take this action now, for tomorrow will be too late.